BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. This show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Tonight, we talk to an ex-Royal Navy captain who's been investigating a charity called Common Purpose. We'll talk about coppicing in the Somerset countryside. A clip from yesteryear of David Frost doing a politically incorrect skit about the world's religions from back in the 60s. Who remembers the TV show That Was the Week That Was? We also have The History of the Mafia, another episode, and of course Jeff Sparks doing a What's On Guide. But first of all, it's the news with Tony Gosling.
And we start this week in Turkey. Thousands of people from various segments of society on Saturday gathered at Tunel Square in Istanbul's Tsakim area to protest the Ergenekon gang, charged with plotting a coup d'etat in Turkey in an event organised jointly by the Young Civilians and the No to Coups platform. Lawyers in their courtroom robes supported the demonstration, demanding democracy, freedom, human rights and the supremacy of law. The protest started at 4 p.m. and many intellectuals, writers, artists and journalists also supported the march. Slogans demanding resistance against military influence and intervention were chanted. People held up posters against illegal and clandestine units inside the military and state bureaucracy, trying to rule the country from behind the scenes. Journalist Ümit Kıvanç also joined the protest. He said the Ergenekon investigation should be continued until the very end. Modern dance performer and choreographer Zeynep Tanbay said 61% of the people in Turkey are against Ergenekon. People have woken up. Rightists, leftists, religious right, atheists, all of them. People want to face the truth. A well-known sociologist, Ferhat Kentel, said attempts to water down the investigation in Turkey would be in vain. An Istanbul court charged Professor Yalçın Kukuk and retired General Mustafa Levent Gökçek with holding the membership of a terrorist organisation in connection with the Ergenekon plot. On Monday this week, the two were among 33 people who were arrested last week in the latest wave of arrests over the plot. Turkey's state-run Anatolia news agency reported the two were sent to jail pending trial. The shadowy Ergenekon group, comprising some 86 retired army officers, politicians and journalists, has been indicted of at least two violent attacks, the bombing of a secularist newspaper in 2006 and an attack on a court in the same year in which a judge was killed. The Saudi Bin Laden group, partnering with the French defence group Thales, has won a multi-million dollar contract for Saudi's ambitious North-South Railway. The two firms were selected by the kingdom to build a signalling and security system for the main 1,800-kilometre section of the USD 2.8 railroad, said London-based Mead magazine. The Palestinian authorities recognised the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court to investigate Israeli war crimes in Gaza. Acting Palestinian Justice Minister Ali Kassan sent a brief letter to the court on January the 21st, which he recognised the authority of the world's first permanent war crimes tribunal. The court made the letter public on Tuesday. The Office of the International Criminal Court said the ICC has begun a preliminary analysis of alleged crimes committed by Israelis during the recent offensive on the Gaza Strip. The Arab League also made an appeal to the UN General Assembly last week to form an international committee to investigate Israeli war crimes on the Gaza Strip and to set up a criminal court to try Israeli war criminals. Meanwhile, Israeli army officers appearing on Israeli television have had their faces blacked out so that they can't be recognised. Former US President Jimmy Carter has become the latest and perhaps the most prominent public figure to express support for a new investigation into the 9/11 attacks. We Are Change Ohio attended a book signing by the former president in Chicago. Carter was asked, "I was just wondering if you'd support the victims' family members that want a new investigation into 9/11. Carter responds, "Yes, I don't have anything to do with it, but I certainly would." Carter told the London Guardian newspaper in October 2004 that President Bush exploited the 9/11 attacks and that the press had not held him to account. "The press have been cowed," he said, "because they didn't want to be unpatriotic." And finally, before suppressing the Gaza appeal for the Disasters Emergency Committee, BBC Director General Mark Thompson sought guidance from experts. Thompson consulted the corporation's Charity Appeals Advisory Committee, made up of representatives of NGOs and international charities, about whether an appeal should be broadcast. The DG's spin doctors told The Guardian, and they raised concerns. This came as a surprise to members of the Appeals Advisory Committee itself, who received no emails about the Gaza appeal before Thompson banned it. Private Eye found one member who was approached for his opinion by the committee's manager, but who raised no concerns at all, fully endorsing the DEC appeal. Another member has since resigned in protest at Thompson's decision. In his resignation letter, he notes that the committee had no involvement in the process.
Thank you to Tony Gosling. Interesting to hear Jimmy Carter in the public eye again. Always worth reminding people that I always take his opinion with a pinch of salt, because during his reign, he did order $20 million to be spent researching whether alien spacecraft did in fact fly to Earth as UFOs. From 10 years ago, here is Pulp with their hit Common People.
Sculpture at St. Martin's College, that's where I caught her eye. She told me that the tap was loaded. I said, "In that case, I'll have room with Coca-Cola." She said, "Fine." And then in 30 seconds time, she said, "I wanna live like common people. I wanna do whatever common people do. Wanna sleep with common people. I wanna sleep with common people like you. Oh, what else could I do?" I said, "Oh, I'll see what I can do." I took her to a supermarket. I don't know why, but I just started somewhere. So it started there. I said, "Pretend you got no money." And she just laughed and said, "Oh, you're so funny." I said, "Yeah. I can't see anyone else smiling. Are you sure? You wanna live like common people? You wanna see whatever common people see? Wanna sleep with common people? You wanna sleep with common people like me?" But she didn't understand. And she just smiled and held my hand. I went and flashed a barber shop. I cut your hair and get a job. I smoked some facts and played some pool. Pretend you never went to school. And still you'll never get it right. It's when you're I
tarot inserts out. Cause everybody hates a tourist, especially one who thinks it's all such a laugh. Yeah, and the cheap stays in grace will come out in the bath. We will never understand how it feels to live your life with no meaning or control. And with nowhere left to go, you are amazed that they exist. And they burn so bright whilst you can only wonder why. A rented flat above a shop. Could you ever get a job? A special fact to play some fool. Pretending I never went to school. A studio.
Bit of class warfare from the lips of Jarvis Cocker there, and that was Pulp with Common People.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
This is a clip from Edge Media Television on Sky Channel 200. This is ex-Royal Navy Captain Brian Gerrish, who used to be involved in military intelligence and has, since retiring, been investigating a charity called Common Purpose.
Went on the internet, looked up a site for an organisation called Common Purpose, very different from the present website, and I thought, what is this? Because it was talking about future leaders in society, and I'd never heard of it. So from that point on, we started to dig, and what we discovered in Plymouth was that it was everywhere, police, hospitals, schools, Chamber of Commerce, but we'd never heard of it. So I'm with colleagues in the Chamber of Commerce who are Common Purpose, but I'd never heard of it. Well, the correct term according to Common Purpose is that they're graduates, but basically they had been selected to do a course, which at that stage was a course called Matrix, which was 48 hours in a secluded environment, a hotel or a small accommodation where people could stay overnight. Mm-hmm. And then following that, a day, a month, for a year. What we were really interested in was the fact that it was talking about creating the new leaders. So you say, one, who is Common Purpose to create these people, and what do these new leaders do? And all we knew was we were living in a bit of a nightmare, because there are threats coming in. You're discovering people are members of an organisation they're not declaring, including the police. And you start to get a picture of something working under the surface of society. I'll take it a step further, because eventually a particular gentleman had a good look at the website, and what he found were documents talking about re-engineering a new society, where Common Purpose leaders would be the people who controlled society. And the bit that we also paid attention to is that they were talking about taking children of the age of 12 to 14 and effectively grooming them to be the new leaders. Now, when I've talked to audiences live now, quite often older people will say, this is what happened in Nazi Germany, Hitler Youth. Well, it's a pretty interesting circumstance when you've had a perfectly good idea to help people and somebody's suppressing it, and also threats and intimidation are used, but I was very lucky because I was with a good group of people who stuck together, and we started to dig. And when we started to dig, we found very interesting things. Well, the key bit is you find a city, which Plymouth was the first one, where you found that people were common purpose in positions of power and influence. And what we started to realise very quickly was that if you had enough people in key positions working for this organisation, then effectively common purpose could control the agenda in a city. And some of the supporting documentation that a colleague of mine, well qualified, read, said absolutely that, how to control your host city. So we began to get a picture that there was a, I'll call it a quasi-political organisation, controlling a city by pulling the levers of key people in positions of power and influence. Well, this is a very important point, because common purpose talks as though you walk into a common purpose office and say, I'd like to do the course, and you do it. That is absolutely not true, because what happens is that groups of what they call senior common purpose people in each city select who will do the course or not. And in my talks and on the website, we show documentation where people are selected, he is in the right position, this is the right head teacher, and other people are rejected. One man in Ipswich is rejected because he's too Ipswich. This is all going on out of the public eye. So what we've got is a group of individuals who could include a policeman, a council officer, a local developer, a vicar, maybe somebody from the local university. They are an advisory board for common purpose, and they are selecting in their community who is okay, who is the right material to be common purpose trained. Common purpose says that it is trying to assist society and create future leaders and educate people. But what we are finding is that where common purpose is operating, never mind what common purpose says, we're finding people who say they're, since common purpose has been operating, things seem to be breaking down. What is actually happening in this country is it's being taken apart. I use an expression, which is, why does nothing work anymore? If you look out the window and you look at what's happening in society, nothing works. Schools, hospitals, transport, police. You must have seen it. Haven't you seen it? And I'll make a statement. I believe this. As an ex-military person, we are heading towards a vicious police state. And at the moment, we know that our politicians are not working for us. We certainly know the House of Lords is not working for us, because they are working for profit. And we need to do something to stop the slide into a police state. And lawful rebellion is taking action within the law in order to stop that situation. But it's time people got off their bottoms to do something to shout and stop what is happening. It's very serious what started to happen in this country. This is a very typical comment. We get a lot of calls and emails ourselves saying this. Our organisation isn't working, whether it's a university or a hospital or a school. And if you speak out about what's actually happening, fraud, corruption, bullying, you get victimised. And what you need to do is join in with other people. So have a look at the British Constitution Group. That's the bcgroup.org.uk website, which is actually talking about lawful rebellion. We had a superb conference in Stoke this Saturday just gone. There was 500 people there, and we were talking about the state of the nation. So we talked about what was happening with the Constitution, the police state. We talked about common purpose, and we actually talked about child snatching. And I can tell you the response from that audience was fantastic. So don't try and fight it on your own, because you get picked off. Join in with other people. And what we have said is that the aim is definitely no violence. Very, very important, this. And what you do has to be inside the law. The government at the moment, in my professional opinion, if I'm allowed to say it like that, the next step is to increase the financial collapse, and then they are going to foment violence on the streets. And the that violence on the streets will be used to trigger the enactment of all of the anti-terrorism legislation, and you are going to be in a police state. So the last thing we need is violence, and I say this to every audience, whether it's to political groups or whether I'm talking to Muslim groups, we are all in this together, and it's very, very important. But for that lady, get involved with other people, learn what other people know, and that is the movement. We need to get millions of people in this country mobilised. It's www.thebcgroup, BC is for British Constitution, thebcgroup.org.uk.
Well, those are the words of Brian Gerrish, an ex-Royal Navy captain, and if you want to find out more, you can always check out ukcolumn.org, which is the website for his newspaper that he also publishes, where you'll find lots of information about European Union fascism and Common Purpose and lots more of that ilk. This is a track from half a decade ago already, slightly scary. This is Magnetic Fields with a song called I Don't Love You Anymore. Magnetic Fields with a track called I Don't Love You Anymore. Now it's time for a clip from about 40, 50 years ago. This is David Frost. I'm sure you all know him. And this is from a show called That Was the Week That Was. I wonder who of you remembers that show. I don't, because I wasn't born yet. But this is a clip he did, a politically incorrect skit about the world's religions.
This week, your Consumer Guide presents its report on religions. Of the dozens of products on the market, we investigated the following six. Judaism, the Roman Catholic Church, the Protestant Church, Islam and Communism. We ruled out Hinduism because it embodies a caste system which we felt was alien to the British consumer. However, the Hindu does believe that animals have souls, every bit as good as human ones. In this sense, it could be said that every Englishman is a Hindu at heart. We began by applying three basic tests. A, what you put into it, B, what you get out of it, and C, how much does it cost? Judaism. This is the oldest religion we tested. Its small number of users, 13 million, is deceptive since many large and powerful subsidiaries derive from it. A, what do you put into it? Belief in one only God, several do's and don'ts. Never prepare milk and meat in the same dish. Do no work between sunset on Friday and sunset on Saturday. And you must cut off the foreskins of your male children. B, what you get out of it. Membership of the oldest club in the world. Prayers and advice are tailored to fit most consumer crises and can also be newly bespoke. You are one of the chosen people. This gives confidence, and we particularly like the guarantee of eternal life through the Messiah, who will take responsibility for all your guilt when he arrives. See, what does it cost? In crockery alone, the expense is fantastic. Plus the wages of a reliable Gentile to run the business between sunset on Friday and sunset on Saturday. Infertility is the only grounds for divorce. We did not try to obtain one. We next tested the Roman Catholic Church. The vigorous new ideas of this splendid corporation were largely pioneered by the previous group. But a sales organization has enabled it to far outstrip the parent company with 340 million current users. Applying the tests, we found A, what do you put into it? Belief in only one Godhead operating on a troika basis. We must stress here that the idea that the head, or pope as he is called, claims infallibility in all matters is a fallacy. The pope cannot tell you which television set is the best. His infallibility is strictly limited to matters of faith. He can only tell you which television programs you mustn't watch. B, what do you get out of it? Principally the new Christianity. The confessional mechanism is standard. The rule here is don't, but if you must, confess as soon as possible afterwards. We found this very useful. A comprehensive life and death advisory service is available from a priesthood unencumbered by family ties. With Roman Catholicism comes a guarantee that it is the only true faith, and exclusive personal survival in heaven is assured. On the whole, we found this product deeply satisfying. What does it cost? A drawback. It is very expensive. During a visit to head office in Rome, a rosary or aid to prayer cost 100 lira. Devotional pictures, 40 lira a time. We were charged 200 lira to see the catacombs. 300 lira to enter the Sistine Chapel, which is very dark. Very dark indeed. And a tour of the anterooms of St. Peter's Basilica cost 300 lira in tips alone. We found it impossible to obtain a divorce. Protestantism. Protestantism is a breakaway from the Roman parent organization. Two main brands are available. The big Church of England or the Nonconformist Economy Pact. What do you put into it? Belief that the Queen should be the head of the church. Belief that the Prime Minister should appoint the Archbishop of Canterbury. And belief in God. What do you get out of it? Independence. How much does it cost? Surprisingly little. We found no difficulty in obtaining a divorce. We next turn to Islam, with 270 million current users, founded 1,300 years ago. It is necessary here to believe in one only God and his true prophet, Muhammad. Begin services with the lesser ablution, wudu, of face, hands and feet. The greater ablution, or ghusl, is being required only after legal pollution, of course. Recite the creed with full understanding once in your life. Go to Mecca once in the life. When you get there, put on two seamless wrappers. Do not shave, trim nails, or anoint the head. Visit the sacred mosque, Masjid al-Haqqa, of course. Kiss the black stone. Go round the Kaaba three times, then four times. Three times walking, four times running. Seven times in all, of course. Visit the Maqam Ibrahim, climb Mount Safar. Run from it to Mount Marwa seven times. Go to Muzdalifa, stay the night. Throw stones at the three pillars of Mina on the great feast day. Offer sacrifice, and if convenient, visit the tomb of Muhammad. What do you get out of it? Up to five wives. How much does it cost? We had to buy a mat, and we found it very exhausting. We didn't need to obtain a divorce. Buddhism. Now, this was the second oldest religion that we tested. It's man-made, flexible, and was designed by Buddha 2,522 years ago. B, what do you get out of it? Nirvana, or a sense of non-being. What does it cost? Nothing. We didn't try to obtain a divorce. We don't understand why communism is on the market at all. It's very recent, mass-produced, and its chief profit appears to have no background in the industry at all. The claim that this shoddy product must inevitably replace all the others in the market we found rather shocking. As in the Church of England, we found no difficulty in obtaining a divorce. In conclusion, we found that as a reward for the good life, all the better religions claim to offer eternal happiness in an everlasting heaven. We decided to test these claims, but were unfortunately unable to find anyone who would undertake this. We apologise for our failure to verify this important aspect of the product. In choosing the Best Buy, we rejected Islam as a cut-price form of Judaism. We liked Buddhism, but the product does not travel well and thrives best in a warm climate. Judaism, we thought, frankly, unsafe. We recommend that unless you have it from birth, you would do well to avoid this product. If you can afford it, Roman Catholicism, with its continental line plus international performance, is well worth having. But we suggest you should think carefully before deciding on it, as it's by no means trouble-free. The attraction of the Church of England lies in its democratic spirit. If you want transubstantiation, you can have transubstantiation. If you don't want transubstantiation, then you don't have to have it. You can just walk down the road into another Church of England church and not have it. If you want Mass, you can have Mass. If you want Immaculate Conception, you can have that too. But nobody will force you to have it if you don't want it. And the church speaks to you in English. Of course, what will happen if we go into the common market? God only knows. But we think it'll still be there, speaking to you in English. And it's a jolly friendly faith. If you are one, there's no onus on you to make anybody else join. In fact, no one need ever know. And it's pretty fair on the whole, too, with some of these products that we've mentioned, Roman Catholicism and Judaism, for instance, you start guilty from the off. But the Church of England is English. On the whole, you start pretty well innocent and they've got to prove you're guilty. All in all, we think you get a jolly good little faith for a very moderate outlay, and we have no hesitation in proclaiming it the Best Buy.
Well, that was David Frost here for the famous catchphrase, "Hello, good evening and welcome," telling us all about the world's religions. I'm sure representatives of all the world's religions have been very grateful ever since.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now it's time for an interview with our very own freelance journalist Tony Gosling about coppicing in Somerset. Good evening.
Hello, John.
Whereabouts are we talking about this coppicing taking place? Where and when?
Well, really, it's at an eco-community called Tinker's Bubble, which is, I suppose, it's about 20, 25 people live there, and they have what they call a low-impact community. The idea is, people basically work on the land growing food and that sort of stuff. They sell it at local markets and live a very sort of simple lifestyle. And one of the most important rules there, I mean, it's some of these places can be quite draconian, but this place, I think, is, you know, is actually very friendly and nice. And but one thing they don't allow is fossil fuels. So the idea is no chainsaws. Say, for example, if you're sawing down a tree there, you use a saw. You don't use a chainsaw because it uses a petrol engine. So the idea is, I think, to sort of try and live as sustainably as possible on the land. And they have temporary planning permission for, I think, the last 15 years or something.
Okay. Is that fairly stable, their sort of
planning permission? Yeah, it is. A lot of people who live there, the original people anyway, were from the Twyford Down road protest. Down in near Southampton, and they were protesting against the roads, but they were conscious that it was be a really good idea to create a community where they were fighting for the way they did want to live, not against the way they didn't want to live. If that makes any sense.
And what is coppicing in relation to this?
Well, woodland needs managing in order for it to be productive and to keep it reasonably tidy, to stop one species taking over. And so what happens is to manage the woodland, you go through the woodland identifying particular species that are, that you want to keep, species you don't want to keep. I mean, for example, laurel as a lot of the laurel trees grow and sort of take over. And that's a non-native species. Also, it doesn't really promote a lot of wildlife, so it kind of kills off a lot of the wildlife and other species around it.
Right.
So the laurel is chopped out, and basically the hazel, which is used for the coppicing, grows really well. I mean, I'm not a woodland management myself, but I can tell you it's a really nice way to spend a weekend, so long as the weather's good.
Okay, so it's a good way to get in touch with a bit of nature that you probably hanker after but never really get around
well,
to.
Well, and also relearn some old country woodland skills. And you get, basically what happens is people get divided up into small groups of about four or five, with one person who's an experienced coppicer who's able to teach them exactly how to do it over the weekend. And by the end of the weekend, quite a large slice of land, something like maybe an eighth of an acre, has been turned from a sort of wild bit of woodland into something which is actually usable and then is producing sort of cropping wood.
Okay, so what do they tend to do with all of the wood once they've got it all? Do they build their houses out of it?
Well,
tools or?
No, I mean, not coppiced wood, no, because that just produces quite short. I mean, it's mostly used for fencing and that sort of thing, the poles right. that are produced from the coppice stools. Mm. So what happens is basically the hazel trees are cut down to a very low level, and what happens when they're cut down is that they produce lots of kind of narrow shoots,
yeah.
And those shoots are really good for fencing and other things.
Okay, why now at this time of year?
It's really just before the spring kicks in is the perfect time to do it, because the trees are basically dormant. And, I mean, if you were to be chopping into them right when they're in the middle of their growth spurt in the spring, that's the wrong time, you know. And then some of them may get diseases and some may die.
Okay.
So this is the perfect time of year to be not just coppicing down in mid-Somerset, but, you know, doing lots of sort of alterations and pruning and things like that in your garden.
Okay, how far out of Bristol are we talking about? What transport is could be available?
Well, it's quite a way, actually. It's down near Yeovil. It's just west of Yeovil, near South Petherton, near Norton. Ham Hill, Norton, Subhamden, but there is a bus that goes from Bristol bus station down there to Wells and to Yeovil, and then there's a smaller bus which goes from Yeovil all days except for Saturday,
okay.
Sorry, except for Sunday, to Norton, Subhamden, which is the nearest village.
Does it bring your own food sort of affair?
No, the food is thrown in for people who are donating their time to help. You know, you get your accommodation and food in, and you get quite well looked after. And usually there's some sort of entertainments and things in the evenings.
Okay, and I imagine that it being a commune, sort of veggies are well catered for.
Well, commune is not quite the right word. Commune suggests...
Okay, the political...
We have to be careful here, because right. The commune suggests that people are all kind of living under the same roof. What happens at Tinker's Bubble is people have... mostly separate dwellings based okay. around a communal roundhouse. So people do every day in the evenings eat together,
yeah.
But they have their own separate places. So I think, you know, I'd stress that it's not the kind of commune with everyone living under the same roof.
Okay, I see. Okay, what equipment might people need to bring with them?
Well, stout boots, waterproof clothing in case the weather's not too good, and warm clothing, as well as, you know, sort of basic things like bill hooks, and if they've got their own tools, bring those along, saws and billhooks, that kind of thing.
And possibly a dirty great a snow shovel.
Well, actually, more important than that really is your roll mat and your sleeping bag. Because although there'll be cover provided for people, somewhere to sleep, there's not enough beds for everyone that turns up for these events.
Yeah, I see. Where can people find out more?
The best thing to do to get the full info and the phone number is to go to Bristol Indie Media website, which is bristol.indymedia.org. At the top left hand side you'll find the calendar, and if you scroll down, which is actually not too far to go now, to the weekend of the 21st and 22nd of February, you find all the full details in there, including the phone number, which I may as well give now.
Okay.
As well, if you'd like to ask any more questions, it's 01935 881 975. So that's 01935 881 975. But do make sure before you call that you've got you know, access to the right kind of equipment, and that is, you know, sort of waterproof clothing, stout boots and sleeping bag and roll mat.
Excellent, thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's time for the fourth in our series of The History of the Mafia, edited and read by the actor Malcolm Grieve.
The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. The relationship between Al Scarface Capone and the city of Chicago was the perfect marriage, and possibly the best example of right time, right place, right face in the history of crime. It might therefore surprise some to learn that Capone was not a native son of Chicago. He was in fact born to Italian immigrant parents who had settled in Brooklyn, New York, 5 years before his birth in 1899. Capone was a graduate of New York's gang-filled streets. He had been both a member of the James Street Gang alongside Lucky Luciano and the Five Points Gang, whose members included Johnny the Fox Torrio. In 1915 it was Torrio and his then-partner Frankie Vale who gave Capone his first organized crime job as a bouncer in the brothel and drinking den, the Harvard Inn. Later that year, Torrio left New York for Chicago, a move that would shape the destinies of both Capone and the city of Chicago. Torrio made the move when his sister called him in to help resolve her husband Diamond Jim Colosimo's problems with black-hand extortionists. Diamond Jim and his wife ran a chain of more than 200 brothels in Chicago that earned them around $600,000 per year. His wealth made him an actual target for black-handers, so when he received a demand for $50,000, Torrio was asked to help out, which he did by arranging for two New York gang members to kill the black-handers when they turned up to collect their money. Colosimo rewarded Torrio with a job helping to run his huge vice operation, which he used as a starting point for carving out his own empire. Torrio worked on the principle of supplying the three things he said people would never get enough of: gambling, alcohol, and sex. And he soon had a chain of establishments that provided all three under one roof. In 1919 he called on Capone to come and join him in Chicago to help him run some of his joints. When Prohibition hit, Torrio realized that the underworld was about to boom, and that bootlegging was going to be the biggest and most profitable business to be in. Colosimo, however, forbade Torrio to get involved in the supply of illicit alcohol. Other gangs were making fortunes, and Torrio realized that Colosimo had to be eliminated if he wanted to take a part of the action. Capone arranged for some hired guns from New York to murder Colosimo. Then he and Torrio set about transforming the dead Colosimo's vice empire into the most powerful bootlegging and organized crime outfit in the Windy City. Between them, Torrio and Capone took control of a number of breweries, arranged protection for illicit shipments of alcohol that were coming into the city, and began to take over other Chicago gangs. Capone arranged for those who would not cooperate with them to meet a bloody end. A typical example of this was when Capone called his former boss, Frankie Vale, to act as the trigger man in the assassination of rival gang leader Dion O'Banion, who ran the mainly Irish North Side Gang, in 1924. O'Banion's death led to a bitter war with the Northsiders, and in 1925 Torrio was shot. Although he survived, he retired from his active role in crime and went back to Brooklyn to enjoy the $30 million he had already made. As he left the city, he said to Capone, "Al, it's all yours." He had, of course, meant their criminal operations, but over the next few years, Capone managed to build them up to the point where he practically controlled the whole city, its politicians, judges, and even the police. Through an ingenious mix of good business arrangements, alliances with gangs outside the Italian-American crime setup, and brutal violence, Capone dominated Chicago's underworld. His combined booze, vice, and gambling empire made more than $105 million a year, and he proved time and again to be beyond the reach of both the law and the gunman's bullet. Between 1925 and 1931, when he was convicted of tax evasion charges, Chicago was truly Capone's city. Although Capone was Chicago's kingpin of crime, his position in the underworld was not without its rivals. In response, he had two ways of dealing with those who challenged him: peaceful cooperation or violent death. Since he had taken over John Torrio's Southside Chicago operation in 1925, Capone had demonstrated magnanimity and fairness in dealing with those who once opposed him. This brought many old adversaries into his outfit. He even employed Frank Galluccio, the man whose knife work in a fight had given Capone the legendary nickname Scarface, as his bodyguard. As long as you bent to Capone's will and did not try to double-cross him, there was a profitable place in his empire, even for the most previously implacable enemies. However, if, as a rival gangster, you refused to make peace with Capone, you were choosing to go to war with someone who was notorious for ensuring his enemies ended their opposition in a hail of bullets. It was a war with a man whose criminal organisation employed more than 1,000 men and had all of the key politicians, police and judges in Chicago in his pocket. It was a choice to fight a war that few could possibly ever hope to win. Capone's fair and generous approach to rivals had brought opponents such as the Saltis McAirlane mob from the west side of Chicago and the Valley Gang into his outfit. One group that refused to do the same was the North Side Gang. Capone had been responsible for arranging the death of the North Side boss, Dionne O'Banion, in November 1924, and the resulting escalation in hostilities had eventually persuaded Torrio to retire and hand over the South Side to Capone. Earl Jaime Vice took over the North Side Gang after O'Banion's death and set about evening the score with Capone. In 1925, Vice and his deputy George Bugs Moran used Thompson submachine guns on Capone's car. It was to be the first of many unsuccessful attempts they made on Capone's life. In September 1926, they fired more than 1,000 bullets into the Hawthorne Inn while Capone was eating his lunch there. After Vice refused Capone's final offer of a peace deal, Capone had him killed by an out-of-town hitman. Typically for Capone, he then offered Moran amnesty and a deal in which he could keep control of the north side of Chicago. He accepted. In 1928, Al bought a huge estate in Florida and moved there with his wife and child. Moran used this as an opportunity to try and muscle in on Capone's territory. It was to be a fateful mistake. Outraged by Moran's treachery, Capone arranged for his right-hand man, Jack Machine Gun McGurn, to take care of Moran permanently. On February 14, 1929, Moran was due to be at his gang's headquarters, a garage at 2122 North Clark Street, to take delivery of a truckload of allegedly hijacked illegal drink from a Detroit gangster. It was a setup. At the appointed time, several of McGurn's men, two dressed in police uniforms and arriving in a stolen police car, raided the garage and told the six Northside members and civilian associate to line up against the wall. Thinking it was a police raid or shakedown, they complied. They were then machine-gunned, their dead bodies falling to the floor, pools of blood forming alongside the oil already on the ground. Moran, who was late for the meeting, arrived just as the police car pulled up. By not entering the garage and fleeing when the shooting started, he survived. However, the power of his gang was broken. When he was later picked up by the police for questioning and asked who was responsible, Moran said, "Only Capone kills guys like that." Although it consolidated his grip on the Chicago underworld, and no one was ever charged with the St. Valentine's Day massacre, the massive bad publicity of such a large and brutal slaying hurt Capone. It brought the anger of the public, federal authorities, and even his fellow mob bosses outside of Chicago down on him, when he considered it his worst mistake and the first domino falling in the collapse of his empire.
Thank you to Malcolm Grieve. What an excellent reader. That was The History of the Mafia, and more of that next week. Now it's time for It's Caper Time from The Italian Job, and of course I mean the original British version, not the American remake, which, even if it did star Donald Sutherland, was sadly crap. Well, I swear on my dear old lady's life, I was having a good dance around the studio while that was on. Fantastic. A couple of interesting points to raise. Apparently, I've been informed that the American-Italian job is due to have a sequel, which is due to be called The Brazilian Job. Titter, titter. And another point is that a university, I can't remember which university it was, has recently conducted a study where they have worked out how, if you remember the end scene, they could get the bus off the edge of the cliff so that they could rescue the gold. Because if you remember in the last scene, the bus is teetering on the edge of the cliff and all the gold is at the back. And then he says, hang on, lads, I've got a brilliant idea. And they've worked out how I can do it. What you do is you smash all the windows, because the windows weigh up to 60 kilograms if you spread out all the weight of the glass all over the bus. Then what you do is you let all the gas out of the tyres, so that flattens the tyres and gives them, doesn't let it roll so much against the ground. And then what you do is you can kind of slide in and pass the gold to the back and get it all out. And they spent ages working it out. See, isn't an education wonderful?
By which time the police would have turned up.
Well, yeah, this is very true. As he's pointed out, by which point the police will have turned up. Lovely old Interpol will have showed up in the helicopter and it'll all be over. Right, now time to pass over to our quiffed, splendiferous human being, Jeff Sparks, for this week's What's On Guide.
Thank you, John, and good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 12th of February, and at Mr. Wolf's in Bristol, Rita Lynch will be performing with support from Alien Stash Tin. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Moving on to Friday, 13th of February, and at the Croft in Bristol, the Dub from Atlantis band will be performing with support from DJ Versus the Drummer and also Substatic. Doors open at 9 p.m. and entry is £8 on the door and £7 for NUS. Finally, on 13th of February, at the Subscription Rooms in Stroud, Soul Destroyers will be performing with support from the Rinky Dinks. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and tickets are £8 and £7 for concessions. Moving on to the Song of the Week, and I decided to bring you something strange, but also funny. Green Jelly formed in 1981, but didn't get commercial success until 1991 with the album Serial Killer Soundtrack. This is a track from that album, and it's titled Obey the Cow God.
I said, on your knees. Get on your knees and pray to the cow. Eat my burger, for it is my flesh, and drink my milk, for it is my blood. Obey.
That was Green Jelly with Obey the Cow God from the album Serial Killer soundtrack. For more information on them, you can check out myspace.com/greenjelly. Moving on to Saturday, 14th of February, and at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol, Mind Z will be performing. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Also on 14th of February, and at the Louisiana in Bristol, Concepts of Inebriation will be performing with support from Morton View. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance. Finally, on to Sunday, 15th of February, and at the Fleece and Firkin in Bristol, Blood of Ash will be performing with support from No Quarter Given. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. And our big friendly giant goes off into the night. Just time before we go for the Dialect Stock Market Insider's tips. Here is this week's tip. Sell! Sell! Sell everything! Sell! Investors are advised to ignore this advice. This loss is intended purely as entertainment. Dialect take no legal responsibility for any action taken in response to this tip. Selling everything may be a crap idea. Well, that's the end of this week's Dialect show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based here in the city centre. Our features were brought to us by Tony Gosling. Thanks as ever to Malcolm Grieve, who read another instalment excellently of The History of the Mafia, to be continued next week. What's On was presented by Jeff Sparks, and Villa Strichkuren was the studio engineer. If you want to get in touch with Tinker's Bubble about the coppicing weekend, you can call the following number, 01935 881 975. And as I say, just mention about the coppicing weekend and they will know what you're talking about. And also remember to look on the Bristol Indymedia webpage for more information about that as well. And that's on the 21st and 22nd of February. This week's show was produced by Tony Gosling, and you can download the show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. Give a shout out to Preston, as we do every week. Hello, guys. Thank you very much. I'm John Peters Coleman, wishing you a very good week. Adieu.